From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, always a pleasure.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Tom Hooker, the president of the Montgomery County Council. We'll also talk with Christina Henderson, an at-large member of the D.C. Council. But joining us now is Walter Smith, the executive director of D.C. Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. Walter Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be discussing with Walter Smith a judgment made against the insurance company CareFirst. Walter Smith, D.C. Appleseed just settled a 12-year dispute with the insurance company CareFirst and the district. What was the nature of the issue?
Well, the nature of the issue was how much excessive surplus the company has that it ought to be devoting to community health care needs.
It was making $1 billion. This is Tom Sherwood. Welcome, Walter Smith. We're going to get to the fact that you were a hula hoop champion in junior high school in a moment. But
oh, let's get to that now. This sounds very interesting.
That's okay. Why he's such good shape today. But listen, the CareFirst, you know, just to summarize for people, makes a fortune, and $1 billion plus, and for 20 years, the city's been trying to get it to do something. It's now agreed to spend $95 million to help poor people who need health care in these horrible times when health care costs are skyrocketing. What does this mean that you've reached this agreement finally?
Well, I think it means that we've set a precedent here. That this nonprofit health insurance company really does need to commit the maximum feasible amount of its surplus and revenues to addressing community health care needs. But it also means that $95 million will soon become available to address those needs, especially for the underserved population here in the city.
You're the Harvard lawyer, so be careful. But does this mean that in coming months, or will it take a couple of months to get it organized, the $95 million will be spent quickly or over a period of time? The people who need the health care, when will they start getting the benefits?
Well, that's not completely clear, Tom. I hope there will be money going out the door from this $95 million by the end of the year. One further step that needs to be set up is they're going to establish an oversight committee that will help establish some of the criteria for how to spend the money. And then the money is going to be administered through local foundations. I know that the mayor and her people have been working through those two issues. And I'm hopeful that in the next week or two, we're going to know who the oversight committee is. We're going to know who the foundations are. And the process that will be put in place so the money can go out the door. For the reason you say, the health care needs here in the city are great, and they've been exacerbated by the pandemic.
Is this one-time money, $95 million spent and gone?
I don't think it is one time. What's ironic about this is that we are settling over how much excess surplus they had at the end of, believe it or not, 2011.
And apparently it was almost $1 billion at that point.
Yeah, yes. And now it's over $1.5 billion. The surplus continues to grow, and therefore the capacity to be using part of it to address healthcare needs in the city also continues to grow. I should say it's very important to point out the statute provides that it's only excessive surplus that we're talking about.
What's the difference between surplus and excessive surplus?
Well, the company always has a surplus.
To pay claims, that's the word.
And other expenses. The statute defines excess surplus as the amount that is left over after they have more than enough to meet all claims and expenses. And the statutory standard is that they should be committing the maximum feasible amount from that surplus.
But ironically, CARE First makes the argument, and this includes the pandemic that we're in right now, that it needs these large annual surpluses so they can sustain the big financial losses that could be caused by national disasters or something like the pandemic. What's your response to that?
Our response to that is that we were willing to use their statistical model to measure how much money they needed to have in reserve to be sure to be able to meet all of the kinds of contingencies that you just mentioned. And one of the ironies, Kojo, is that one of the contingencies they used to talk about early in these proceedings was, what if there's a pandemic? And what has happened is they've actually grown their surplus.
That's what I find surprising.
Insurance companies are in business to make money and to provide benefits.
But this is a nonprofit.
Well, they still make money. They have to pay all their people, and so
they do. They do. And we want them to be able to meet all of their claims and all of their expenses, but precisely because they're a nonprofit, we want them to use, again, what the statute says is the maximum feasible amount every year. Not just from their surplus, but from their annual operating revenue. To go back to what Tom was asking about a minute ago, what we have settled is how much they need to be spending from their excessive surplus as of the end of 11. We're now 10 years later, the surplus is much larger, and so there may be further opportunities, either through action by the mayor or by the council or by us, to require them on an annual basis to be committing more to community health.
We're talking about helping not hundreds of people, but thousands of people with insurance problems, right?
Well, not only with insurance problems, but with
healthcare itself. You were talking about thousands of people could be helped overall, not just a few hundred. Before it goes, can we talk about Walter Smith for a moment?
The hula hoop to Walter Smith?
Well, that, yes. But, you know, Walter Smith has run the Appleseed Center for Law and Justice for nearly 20 years. And he's leaving, I think, at the end of this year. And the Appleseed, for people who don't know, has been involved, and you name it, they've been involved with the voting rights, health care, civil rights, criminal rights, you name the issue,
education.
They've been involved. And they do not, and here's the key point, they do not take government money. It's been a truly nonprofit involved in the city. And I don't say this very often, Walter Smith, but thank you.
Well, thank you for pointing all of that out. I'm glad you mentioned it, because since I am going to be departing, we're going to want to bring in a new executive director to build on what we've done so far. And the fact we have been able to work on so many things that we have, I'm hoping, it's going to mean we will attract someone of great stature and skill.
Are you taking your hula hoop with you? You were the champion in Oklahoma of junior high school. I won't say what year that was, but it was a while ago.
Yes, indeed. I don't do a lot of hula hooping now. But as you know, Tom, I do a lot of bike riding. You probably remember when I biked across the country to promote DC voting rights, which has long been what Appleseed's focus area.
And you've jumped through a lot of hoops in your business. So that's again, congratulations, Walter. Glad you joined us today.
Walter Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Walter Smith is the executive director of the DC Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. Joining us now is Christina Henderson, who is an at-large member of the DC Council. Councilmember Henderson, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me again.
Before we discuss specifically what Christina Henderson is here to talk about, Tom Sherwood, let's talk about another aspect of the council, and that is the upcoming election. And there's already been a debate among the crowded field, as the headline by Martin Ostermule said, of Ward 5 candidates. Among that crowded field are two former Ward 5 representatives on the council, Vincent Orange and Tommy Thomas, or Harry Thomas Jr.
Right, Harry L. Correct. Thomas, as they said in court. Yes, this is the first forum in Ward 5. Kenyon McDuffie, the Ward 5 council member, is running for attorney general, not seeking re-election. The D.C. for Democracy held a forum this week with the five candidates. One of them is Harry Thomas, who back in 2012 pled guilty to a felony of stealing $350,000 from city youth programs. He spent just over 3 years in prison and on probation for a couple of years. And now he says he's a reformed person and he wants back in the public arena to represent Ward 5. Vincent Orange, who used to represent Ward 5 and was an at-large council member, left to take a job, got defeated at large. Work for the D.C. Chamber. He, too, has joined the race to be the Ward 5 council member again. And just mention the other three candidates are Zachary Parker, who's a Ward 5 school board member, Faith Gibson Hubbard, who's a Woodridge civic leader and senior official in the Bowser administration, or was, and Gordon Fletcher, an ANC member from North Michigan Park and head of the Ward 5 Dems.
In his defense, Harry Thomas Jr. says he has learned his lesson and that he has been serving the ward in recent years. I think he's an ANC, right?
Well, he's also been elected to an ANC, but the issue will be have the people of Ward 5 believe that he's moved on?
One should recall that his father, Harry Thomas, once held that position as the Ward 5 council member. And I bet you that Christina Henderson has already endorsed somebody in this race. Have you yet, Councilmember Henderson? Is there anyone you'd like to name that you support?
Well, you know, first off, I would like to say, you know, I can't vote in the June primary because I am not a registered Democrat. So, you know, lots of folks stayed out of my race and I want to do them the courtesy of staying out of theirs. I'm interested to see what happens, though.
we do spend a lot of time talking about allowing returning citizens opportunities to having made amends for their transgressions to be back in the public life. Do you have any thoughts about a person who pled guilty to a felony running for office?
Well, I think that the residents in Ward 5 are quite capable of determining, you know.
You're not going to answer. Let's move on. Do you have a hula hoop?
Do I have a hula hoop?
Yes, as a new mother.
Do you know what a hula hoop is?
Did you hear us talking about the hula hoop with Walter Smith?
I did. No, I don't have a hula hoop, but I'm familiar with a hula hoop. Yeah, okay. Obviously.
Those of us of a certain age are intimately familiar with hula hoops. Let's talk about the GC jail. Last week, you and some of your colleagues visited the jail to look at conditions there. What were your big takeaways from that trip?
Well, so I think my biggest takeaway, you know, I first went to the D.C. jail when I was a staffer with Councilmember Grasso, you know, about 8 years ago. And the jail looks exactly the same then or today as it did then. You know, I think we have some serious infrastructure issues that need to be addressed there. You know, one of the things that kind of stood out to me is depending on what floor you are, you got a whole different temperature. They've had serious issues with HVAC. They've had some issues with plumbing before. And I think when you have a, you know, 40-year-old building in one and a 30-year-old building in the other, we have to seriously consider, do we continue to put millions of dollars into maintenance or do we get a new facility?
There was a hearing on the council. Charles Allen, chair of the Judiciary Committee, held a hearing about it. And the director of the Department of Corrections was not there. He's on leave. Do you happen to know why he's on leave?
No, I don't know why Director Roof was on leave. He did join us for the tour last week, and I know that was he hadn't been planning to because he had another commitment, and so I'm not sure why he wasn't there.
One of the unusual politics things about this is that Carl Racine, who is the Attorney General of the district and legally represents the city agencies, including the Department of Corrections, appeared at that hearing with Charles Allen and said that he recognized he's the lawyer for the corrections department, but then went on to castigate the city, Mayor Bowser, not by name, for failing to fix the problems at the jail. Some people have since told me that was somewhat unusual that the attorney for the city is taking the sides of the people criticizing the jail. Did that strike you as odd?
It didn't necessarily strike me as odd, but I think some of the things that Attorney General Racine was talking about, I think everybody acknowledges that there are problems there with the jail infrastructure. Serious problems.
Right. So if you sue the city for its failure to do something at the D.C. jail, you can cite the city's own lawyer in your lawsuit.
Well, yes. Well,
seems
you don't know.
Let's
see if we can get a technical answer to this question from a caller by the name of Carl Racine. Carl Racine, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Chris. Councilmember Henderson, I'm so sorry to interject on your time. And, you know, the reason why I called, honestly, is because my office has, of course, been corresponding with Tom Sherwood on this
morning.
For now about 20. Hey, good morning, Tom. This afternoon, for the last 30 minutes, I find it interesting that he's refused in his questioning to be balanced or even ask us to get on the show and defend ourselves. That's why I decided to call.
I'm glad you called. First of all, I don't invite people on the show, but I'm glad you called because we were just several people.
Ask the question, Mr.
Yes,
Sherwood,
but I would welcome you. How is it that you can be the lawyer for the city and then step aside in your public, as your citizen's role, and criticize the corrections department? Won't you be named in any lawsuits that come up?
It's a fair question. It's a fair question.
Well, that's what I think it is, too, so I'll let you answer.
Can I answer? Can I answer, please? The question is fair, and Tom, thank you, Kojo, for allowing me to answer. As you know, Kojo, Tom, I asked you to go back and look at the statute that created the independent attorney general. My job is to provide defense for city agencies. And of course, my job as part of that responsibility is to never breach my professional responsibilities, including breaching the attorney-client privilege or any information that I've gleaned from conversations with the agency. I have not done that. And never would.
And you made that statement. And you made that statement.
Kojo made that statement
in the public hearing. I know you made that statement in the public hearing.
Right. Kojo, can I finish?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Because, Tom, you know the statute has another aspect. And, Tom, you may not want to hear it, but here it is. It requires me a mandate to act in the public interest. And the publicly acknowledged, as the council member said, and publicly reported incidents related to the D.C. jail that disproportionately impacted black and brown residents required this attorney general in his public interest to criticize exactly the conclusion of what occurred, ask for better leadership on that issue, and ask for seriousness around money and a new jail.
Well, I do have to get back to Christina Henderson, but I do have to ask you this, Carl Racine, because Tom posed the question that if, in fact, the city is sued, on the one hand, your office is required to defend the city. On the other hand, it can be argued that the remarks you have made about the D.C. jail can be used against you as you are defending the city.
No, because I made no assertions of fact. I understand my ethical obligations well. To date, even the people who Tom talks to as his sources have not filed a bar complaint because it'll fail. They've not. I'm still the lawyer, and I get fired sometimes. So I'm still the lawyer. So okay. It's a one-sided set of questions that Tom Sherwood just got called out on. Thank you.
Well, that's certainly not a matter of fact, but go ahead. It's great that you called in.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Carl Racine. Christina Henderson, let's get back to you because there are a lot of people who want to talk with you about a specific issue, so allow me to go directly to that issue. The council is holding its first public hearing for your ranked choice voting bill next week. Remind
That's
our
correct.
Listeners how ranked choice voting works and why do you think it's the way to go here in D.C.?
Yep. So in a competitive election, ranked choice voting essentially allows folks to exercise their full voice. When you get the ballot, it would ask you, who do you pick as your first choice? Who do you pick as your second choice? And so forth and so on. And then in terms of the tabulation on the back end, when the D.C. Board of Election runs it, if no one has gotten 50% of the vote, the person who has gotten the least number, they would be eliminated and their second votes would be redistributed to the remaining candidates. And you would continue in that process until someone has reached 50%.
And that's how it worked in the New York Democratic mayoral primary. But Nadia in D.C. has a question about that. Nadia, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Councilmember Henderson. I wanted to ask you how you believe ranked choice voting helps women and people of color.
I should say that when we talked to Mayor Bowser about that, she pointed out that a man happened to win the New York Democratic mayoral primary. Of course, that man also happens to be a black man. So. Right. Served exactly. At least half of the purpose. But go ahead, Christina Henderson.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that New York, and first, thank you for the question. I think that New York gives us our best demonstration of how it helps a lot of women and people of color. The New York City Council used ranked choice voting for the first time this year, and now they have a female majority, and they also have the most diverse council will be starting there soon. So I think it gives... I think it gives more candidates an opportunity to make a case. And no one is worried about, are you going to be a spoiler or that I'm wasting my vote? But it really allows for voters to vote for whoever they feel like is the best person for the job.
Nadia, does that answer your question?
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
Let me see. Does it answer your question, Ankit, in D.C.?
I think so. Okay. I pretty much had the same question. If you don't mind, I could ask another one.
No, that's all right. We want to move on to other issues. Thank you very much for your call.
I have a comment about this.
Yes, go right ahead.
I don't want to get Carl Racine calling me back, but
Council Member, involved in ranked choice voting too.
Council Member, we've changed the primary date several times, even though you can't vote in them. We've changed the fair elections, yep. Which is starting to work, and I think people like it pretty much so far.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're adding ranked choice. I was talking to a person who's active in the city, and he said, "Are we doing too many changes too fast?" And now this ranked choice would not take place until the 2024 elections, not next year.
Correct.
2022. But is there money in the budget for the elections board to educate citizens on how this will work? It seems simple to those of us who pay attention, but a lot of people are somewhat confused by it. Is your idea that there would be a significant education campaign along with the legislation?
That's correct. So that's part of the bill. So part one of the bill is just sort of dealing with the mechanics of ranked choice voting. But part two of the bill would task DC Board of Elections to do a significant voter outreach campaign explaining this. You know, we know from the data from places like Minnesota and New York that 85% of the people said that they understood, you know, when polled around, you know, the ballot and how it worked. And that was because you not only had the Board of Elections doing it and campaigns, but you also had a significant amount of civic organizations who are educating folks as well. And I've heard from a lot of people say, you know, oh, I don't know if voters can understand. Well, I have faith in the voters that they can figure this out, that they can understand a new system of voting. But, you know, you asked if there's money in the budget. Just a reminder, everybody, right? We have to have a hearing first. And that happens on this upcoming Thursday. And then it is a decision in terms of whether or not the Committee on the Judiciary will choose to move this forward to the full council and then what happens from there. I am not a person who believes that you just got one shot at something. If for some reason my colleagues don't feel that this is the right time, then we will keep trying, and that's okay. But you know, I think it's very healthy for us to have this debate about whether or not our current election system is working.
I think our local Democratic Party, the DC Democrats, they voted. There weren't a lot of people who voted, I don't think, but they did in fact vote to raise questions or to oppose it. Is that still their position?
My understanding is that they did pass a resolution on that, yes.
I've seen it. You introduced a bill last month that would require D.C. students to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. The deadline mm-hmm. to be fully vaccinated is December 15th. Why do you think requiring kids to be vaccinated is the right approach?
Well, I think we know that vaccination is one of the best tools that we have to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 and to keep kids in the classrooms and keep our school communities safe, and not just our school communities, but also our early childhood communities as well. Obviously, the date is not going
to
work.
I was about to say, that's the problem. Yes.
Yep. We just held a hearing on it, and I thought we had a really robust conversation around the best way to move forward. And so expect to see some modifications in terms of the timeline. But I think for my colleagues and I, right, you know, we require lots of vaccinations for students to attend school now, polio, measles, mumps, rubella, et cetera. And so we, you know, the idea is that we're just going to add COVID-19 to that list. Okay. And so I look forward to
Just very quickly, we need to get the lines for the parents taking their kids to get vaccinated are too long. There needs to be more healthcare sites for
Got to take a short break. We're talking with Christina Henderson, an at-large member of the D.C. Council. I'm Coach Onan. Welcome back. Our guest is Christina Henderson, an at-large member of the D.C. Council. We'll soon be joined by Tom Hooker, the president of the Montgomery County Council. Councilmember Henderson, we got a tweet from someone who said, could you please ask Councilmember Henderson when the council would discuss where to appropriate funds from the infrastructure bill and if she has any priorities for what to use the funding for?
That's a great question. The council cannot initiate appropriations bills, so I imagine that that debate will happen probably in the early in the new year with the mayor in terms of the budget. But one of the things that I'm super interested in is around, one, the investments that they're making to WMATA and our public transportation system, which I think, you know, anyone who commutes knows it's desperately needed. Electric vehicle and fleet maintenance there. And then also I'm interested in how we can creatively use some of that funding to deal with 295.
So, Eleanor Holmes Norton put out a quick note on this. I'll just tell you that under this bill, the infrastructure bill, the D.C. government will get $1 billion for roads and bridges, $1.2 billion for improved public transportation. It can apply for another $2 billion in funding for electric vehicles. Just $10 million to protect against cyber attacks. There's a lot of money coming to the city, just like there was with the federal relief program during COVID.
You are on DC.
You have a lot of money to spend.
I'm excited to serve on the Committee on Transportation.
I heard a rumor that you might run for the council chairmanship next year. Is that true?
Tom, okay.
I'm just trying to irritate every guest here today.
In other words, he's being
Tom. I am comfortable in the job that I am currently in, and no, I am not seeking another office at this time.
Oh, we won't get to make news about that here. You're on the council's subcommittee on redistricting. What are some of the big changes being considered? What have you heard from residents about their priorities?
Well, that's a great question, Kojo. We're getting ready to this point of landing the plane on our first half of the redistricting proposal. The subcommittee is soon going to vote on a recommendation to send to the full council. And I think that, you know, we've had 11 public hearings, 11 on this topic. We've heard from thousands of residents. Almost 200 residents have submitted maps, their own maps, to the process. And just the fact of the matter is by the numbers, we know that wards 7 and 8 have to add to the population. And Ward 6, unfortunately, needs to shrink. And so we are going to be dealing with those lines to try to make the math work.
Sorry, I got distracted there just for a moment. I think it's something else irritating to say right now. But, you know, you're a fairly new mother, is that right?
I am. I don't know if you can hear my little one crying downstairs, but yes.
Well, that's not why I asked that question. But it makes me worry when I see the long lines for people who are trying to get their children 5 to 12, whatever their age is now. The lines were just way too long. I don't see how that can be sustained.
Yep. So, I mean, Kojo, I went out on last Friday, with both of my kids, actually. I have a 2-year-old and a 2-month-old. And I went out to Fort Stanton because I wanted to see for myself what was happening there. As soon as I saw turned the corner towards the rec center and saw the line, I was like, oh, no, we have a problem here. But that was the first day in terms of, and I know that there are first day kinks. Had conversations with the officials over at DC Health. And, you know, what we have seen happen over the last week, where we have had other vaccination pop-up clinics in multiple locations, is that not many of them have actually been at full capacity. So we have some that have had vaccine on the table. I encourage folks to check in with the DC Health Twitter account if you're not going to go to a site at the start. Each site has 250 doses. And so we're going to work through it as best as possible. But I agree with you, Tom. I am uncomfortable with hundreds of kids and families standing in line only to find out that there are no more vaccine doses there. But I think that we have worked out the kinks, and hopefully over the next few weeks, we'll get thousands of more kids vaccinated.
Only about a minute left, but next week there'll be a public hearing for DC's Comprehensive Cannabis Legislation and Legalization and Regulation Act, which you co-introduced. What would this bill do, quickly?
So this bill would essentially set up a true tax and regulate legalization system for adults to be able to purchase recreational cannabis. And it would set up a system whereby we can deal with the illicit market as well. Excited for this legislation, but since we only have a little bit of time left, I'll just say we really, really, really need Congress to lift the rider that are in the appropriations bills to allow for DC to move forward, as 18 other states have already done so.
Given our time limits, you could have skipped two of those reallys, but that's all right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. Christina Henderson is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. Joining us now is Tom. You're welcome. Tom Hooker is president of the Montgomery County Council. He joins us now in studio. Tom Hooker, welcome.
Thank you, Kojo.
Glad you could join us in studio. As Tom Sherwood pointed out, you are our first in-studio guest since March of 2020. So thank you for making it over here. Before we get to Montgomery County, quickly, Tom Sherwood, Virginia
I'm
Governor.
I'm sending a text message to Carl Racine. Can we just hold the show for about 30 minutes while we get the, no, I'm just teasing.
No.
Okay, I can multitask here. Go ahead.
Let's talk about what's happening in Virginia, where Governor-elect Glenn Youngkin has put together a transition team. The most significant member, in my view, of that transition team, it consists of several former Republican governors and one former Democratic governor, Douglas Wilder.
You know, Doug Wilder, his career as a state senator and governor and governor and everything, a candidate for president, has his own drummer, and he marches to it. And he, during the campaign, 10 days before the November election, criticized Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, and the current sitting governor, Ralph Northam, for failing to support the historically black colleges and universities in Virginia, and pointed out in the public statement that Glenn Youngkin, the Republican candidate at the time, had said he would, in fact, help fund those universities. So it doesn't surprise me at all that Glenn Youngkin has returned the favor and invited Governor Wilder to be on this transition-style committee, along with Republican governors, former governors, Bob McDonnell, Jim Gilmore, and George Allen. If you want to know what Doug Wilder thinks, all you have to do is ask him or just listen. He'll tell you. He's been an irritant on the side of Terry McAuliffe when he was governor, and he wants what he wants, and he's not shy about saying it. So I hope he does help Glenn Youngkin, because Youngkin's got a lot of work to do with the Democratic Senate and a new Republican House.
Long has a reputation as a kind of maverick in the Democratic Party in Virginia. Tom Hooker, the Montgomery County Council just passed a new bill that changes when and how police body-worn camera footage is reviewed. This came after the delayed release of a video that showed Montgomery County police officers harassing a 5-year-old black boy. You were the lead sponsor of this bill. Tell us what it does and why it was a priority for you.
I was. Thank you, Kojo. Your listeners will remember back in May 2020, we all found out, but made national news when two of our officers were screaming abuse in the face of this 5-year-old boy who had wandered off elementary school campus in my district. They put him in the back of a squad car, they handcuffed him to scare him, and then when his mom arrived, they lectured her about how she should be beating him more often. And just not leaving any marks or burns. Yeah. So the problem came about not just because of their behavior, but also because we found out about it when you did through the media and through an intrepid reporter that looked at the court documents. This bill requires random review of all our thousands of hours of body cam footage. It requires reporting of serious investigations to the chief right away, those involving a child, use of force, discrimination, possible crime by our officers, and then that requires the chief to report it to the council, the county executive, and the state's attorney right away as well. So the public will find out, and so the state's attorney has the option of bringing charges, which he didn't in this case because the statute of limitations had passed.
But the family of the young boy brought a lawsuit against the county and the school district following that incident. Do you know where that stands now?
Well, I do, and I can tell you what is on the public record. Unfortunately, the child who was 5 at the time is now 7. The county has been fighting this lawsuit for over a year. We have 2 outside law firms that the county attorneys have brought on, plus we're paying them, plus our own county attorneys. The county has been, in my view, re-traumatizing this boy by ordering an outside mental health assessment 2 years after the fact and prolonging the ordeal instead of just allowing them to have some closure. I don't know how much money we've spent fighting this lawsuit. I don't know why the county executive hasn't just apologized and settled the case and moved on. In my view, that's exactly what we should be doing. It's the right thing to do. It's leadership, and it would help rebuild our trust in our police force. The facts of the case are not in dispute. They're all on YouTube. You could look them up right now.
Your criticism of the county executive gives the opportunity for Tom Sherwood to bring up this being the politics hour.
Yes. You know, you told us last summer or late last spring, it seems some time ago, that you were considering, thinking about, going to look about running for county executive. You have not said publicly what you're going to do, but you've sent out emails to people. I happen to have one of them where you say, I'm planning to run for Montgomery County executive, and with your support, I'll be an effective leader, et cetera, et cetera. You're having a big event on Sunday. You're collecting $1,000 a person for people who want to pay that much to be a co-sponsor. Let's see, I've got the invitation here at the home of somebody. Anyway, the home of Matt Kaiser. You're raising money. You haven't said you're running. You're apparently going to run for county executive. Are you announcing Sunday?
Well, Tom, I'm planning to run.
This is just general money here?
No, I hear you. I mean, you know, I think most of us raise money for our campaigns year-round. But the point is, I'm planning to run. But right now, I'm focused on finishing my term as county council president.
Yeah, but
I'm very proud of
the
council.
That ends in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You get replaced by Mr. Albanaz, right, in December?
I assume so, yes.
Right. So
that's up to the council.
That's not taking a lot of your time. You've been the whole year as a chairman.
Oh, it is taking a lot of my time, believe me.
Well, you've got, so what's the deal? Why not just say you're going to run, but you're not ready to formally get in the race?
Well, because I take my job very seriously right now as council president. I'm very proud of what the council's been able to do this year during my term. We have passed multiple Board of Health regulations that have kept the public safe. We have kept restrictions in place. When the governor took the power away from the county executive to do so, we're just awarded a award by the NAACP, whose president said we've been the best council she's seen in 20 years. We just received an award from a former House group.
All that's good, but that doesn't keep you from telling us. Yes, you told people in the email.
Run. Yep.
You're running. When are you going? When will you announce, in January? Or
saying he's planning to run is good enough for me. the formal announcement.
Well,
what difference does that make?
Because it makes a big difference in terms of things like what he's doing with the Silver Spring bid and.
We have questions about all of that.
And the council be acting as the health department. There's lots of things.
All right. We have questions about all of those things. Maybe during the course of his answers, we'll get some more revealing information about Tom Hooker's plan, because the council is expected to vote soon on a new general plan for the county, which outlines housing development, transit, and other policies for the next 30 years. It's already received a lot of pushback, particularly around allowing mixed housing into single-family neighborhoods. Before I go to my question, here is Kim in Gaithersburg. Kim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I have been a resident of Gaithersburg for over 30 years, and I wonder why, instead of proposing the massive change that is unwanted to zoning in neighborhoods, why the county doesn't instead use land that is currently underutilized and in excellent locations for building multi-storied affordable condominiums and apartments near bus transit, such as where the Lake Forest Mall currently is, which is basically a dead business and has a major bus stop.
Maybe a good suggestion, Kim, but my question to you is, are you opposed to mixed housing coming to your neighborhood?
Absolutely. Not just my neighborhood, but I've owned all over the Gaithersburg area, both homes that I've lived in as well as some rental units. And I can tell you, after interacting with people living in those neighborhoods, my tenants, the neighbors, people on the boards, and I've actually served on one of the
HOA boards, opposed to mixed housing. So allow me to have Tom Hooker respond.
Sure. Thank you, Kojo. Kim reflects, I think, an awful lot of the misinformation that has been out there, unfortunately, about the plan. Just to start at the beginning, this is the county's general plan. So it is a general, non-binding guideline for where, how we set up our communities and how we manage our transportation to get from here to there. It does not change any zoning. People think it does. I want to say over and over, it doesn't change any zoning. Period, full stop. We're required to have a, by law, to have a general plan. And the last one we updated was in 1993. So in many ways, we're out of compliance with that. And you can imagine, Montgomery County is quite different than it was in 1993. That plan doesn't mention climate change, obviously. It doesn't mention racial equity, obviously. And those are two things that are in the forefront of our planning right now.
Housing shortage.
It does. Yeah. And we have ambitious housing goals. But the plan, I think if people read it, they will find it very non-controversial because it basically confirms what most people believe in. Smart growth, avoiding sprawl, maintaining our ag reserve, which is nationally recognized, and building 15-minute communities, which is the idea that we should try to put jobs and housing and retail all together so you can get everything you need for your daily life, like a grocery store and a dry cleaner, within 15 minutes and avoid long commutes. Most people believe in all those things. And our general plan doesn't reflect that.
This could have to do with your plans to run for county executive. When will the county council vote on the new general plan? Will it be before the end of the year?
I don't know about before the end of the year. We just so people are familiar with the process, the planning board held many hearings on this and sent it to the planning and housing committee. They've reviewed it all summer long, and they recently sent it to the full council, which I chair, and the full council will now take it up. I'm letting the Fed chair, the planning chair, planning and housing committee chair, brief us all on the changes that he made in that committee and get the other six of us up to speed on the new amended plan. We'll have another set of public hearings and input from people, and then it'll be up to probably the new president how quickly we move ahead.
Kim, thank you very much for your call.
The county is growing exponentially. You need 50,000 new homes that are affordable and all kinds of different things. So that's a really important thing for Thrive Montgomery. Mm-hmm. But I think the key thing you said is this is not a zoning change. You're not getting rid of single family zoning and things like that, although there'll be some subject. Is that right?
No, that's right. It doesn't affect zoning, and I think people are confused with a study on attainable housing that the planning board is also doing separately, which is a completely separate document.
And since this is the politics hour, Kojo cut me off before I could ask you the other question I want to ask. Mm-hmm. When you announced you're going to run for county executive, will you run a public financing campaign? Montgomery County has a robust public financing system in place. A 6-to-1 match, 5-to-1 match, a lot of money, $750,000 max.
Right.
Will you run a public finance campaign?
I haven't decided that yet.
Vote for it?
Well, yeah, I vote for it. I've always been a supporter of public financing. In fact, I helped pass the Blue Ribbon Commission that passed the state law that allowed it.
Why not do it?
Well, because two things. One, it's not really intended for experienced candidates because it does take money, $5 million out of the Treasury that we could be spending on nurses and firefighters. And two, because there's very well-funded candidates already in this campaign. And so I have to make a strategic decision about whether it makes sense or not.
Mr. Mark Elrich is the incumbent, and I think he's running a public finance campaign. Is that right?
Yeah,
well-to-do man who nearly was elected 4 years ago. He's running a traditional campaign. Hans Reimer?
Reimer.
Is he doing a public finance campaign?
I believe so. I think anybody who wants to know how I'll vote on things can just look at my 15-year record. That's the main thing. And I was ranked, of course, when I was here as a delegate to the General Assembly, ranked as the most progressive member of the Maryland Delegate Assembly. So I don't think in the Maryland General Assembly.
Well, you
Assembly,
know, your critics will say you're going to get the big money from developers, even as you're doing Thrive Montgomery 50-year plan, 2050 plan. You're doing the Silver Spring bid thing, which had mixed reactions from people.
Got a question about that?
And yes, the question is, generally speaking.
No, I'm saying I have a question about the Silver Spring bid.
I thought you wanted me to hurry up.
No.
Anyway, that's the deal, that you'll have enough business money because of all these different things, money which are good. I'm not saying they're bad,
right.
Just that you'll raise a lot more money if you could go traditional route instead of the public finance campaign.
Well, I don't know if that's true. But anyway, I guess we'll see. I'm proud that I have a very broad, diverse group of supporters from the business community, labor, progressives, environmentalists, homeowners.
Since Tom brought up the Silver Spring bid, we got an email from Lean who said, I'd just like to know why it was okay to go against minority women, small business owners who said no to a bid. For those who are unfamiliar with it, a bid is a business investment district. And when the council's own racial equity and social justice analysis said it was not good.
I think Lenny might have not seen the updates and the amendments to the bid legislation. The analysis that she's commenting on was responded to by the council, and the bid was
done last February before you responded, was amended quite a bit.
Yeah, and then two, the bid, I think, you know, stands for Business Improvement Districts. I believe in business improvement, right? And your listeners in the metro area are very familiar with the Golden Triangle in downtown D.C., with the Anacostia bid, with the H Street bid, with the Arlington and Alexandria bids. I've been in touch with the Anacostia bid, the H Street bid, many others to look at their best practices. They have been extremely effective at maintaining and building capital for minority-owned, independent, and immigrant-owned businesses. And that's what we're hoping to bring to Silver Spring, where our businesses are hanging by a thread. We lost 27 restaurants in the last year, and we don't give them nearly the support that other jurisdictions do.
Mark Elrich, the county executive, vetoed this initially, and then it was the council overrode the veto. 8-1
Right.
Was it Mr. Jawando who voted against it?
Mm-hmm.
And he still maintains, and maybe enough changes, that if you look at the power structure of the bid, that it's still white, basically white-owned businesses, big businesses, have too much of the power, and that the smaller minority black and brown businesses have less. Is it equal balanced at all? Where is the power?
Yeah, we added seats to the board to reflect both small, I forget the total, but we added small and medium-sized businesses. But we also put in place, we are constrained by who sits on the board by state law. So I can't change state law. And there will be an attempt to improve, you know, the composition through state law. But two, we can't just sit around waiting for that. We have to do something now to help market our businesses in Silver Spring.
Talk about your masking situation in Montgomery County, because we're running out of time and several people have questions about that. Montgomery County lifted its mask mandate at the end of October, then immediately saw case numbers go up. It's my understanding that the indoor mask mandate is no longer in effect, but it could go back into effect after 7 consecutive days of quote-unquote substantial transmission. Let me give you some of the questions we're having. Okay. Aaron tweeted at us, it would be great if you could ask Councilmember Hucker when he thinks all COVID restrictions, including masking kids in schools, should end, given Montgomery County's extremely high vaccination rate and extremely low hospitalization rate. There clearly is some confusion here.
Yeah, well, understandably. The Board of Health, of course, that the council serves as our Board of Health, and so I chair that. And we've gotten this far with the nationally recognized good numbers because we followed the advice of our public health team. Our public health team advised us on the last amendments to the Board of Health regulation, which says that the mask mandate goes away if we have 7 consecutive days in moderate transmission as defined by the CDC, which we're in now. But unfortunately, the last 3 days, we've gone up to substantial.
I thought they initially said 14 days, and the council changed it to 7. 7 days. Did I have that wrong? I thought the health officials
I think it changed the day before. But anyway,
have 1 minute left.
Got it. But the whole thing goes away, expires when we get to 85% vaccination rate. And we're at 77.9 as of November 10th. 87% have had one dose. So I think we're very close to getting to the 85% vaccination rate that makes the whole Board of Health regulation go away. If people want the mask mandate to go away, which we all do, they should encourage everybody they know to go get vaccinated.
I'm going to give Lisa in Gaithersburg the last question. Lisa, you're on the air, but please be brief.
Okay, thank you. And I want to thank Council President Hucker for his hard work during this
time. But go ahead.
All right. Tom,
I like that part.
In Gaithersburg, and I'm going to ask you about cell towers. I know you believe in science because we just talked about the vaccine, and yet you voted yes, surprising many people, to deploy cell towers 30 feet from homes. Unfettered, and the FCC was found guilty in August of
evidence.
The only jurisdiction that didn't have that authorization in place. Our county attorney is telling us we have to put something in place, we'll get sued and lose to the carriers. And I don't want to see $10 or $20 million that should be going to our schools and firefighters going to the carriers. So we amended the bill. We made it as public facing and public friendly as we could. And I really hope the FCC changes the rules.
Tom Hucker, thank you. you for joining us. That's all the time we have. Before you go, don't go. At 1 p.m., you'll hear a rebroadcast of the latest Kojo in our community event, where I talk with local doctors about the gaps in our healthcare system, and I talk with author Marita Golden about her new book that looks at the problems of the strong black woman complex. That's coming up in a few minutes here. Any big plans this weekend, Tom, shall we?
I'm going to rest from my battering by the Attorney General.
Yeah, you need some rest. That was a battering. Thanks to all of you for listening, and stay safe. Stay safe. I am Kojo Nam.
Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobsdorf. Today's engineer was Kellen Quigley, and our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Our phone screener is Bruce Romer. Mana Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.